Nobody really means for their stuff to fail. So why does it after you've done your best engineering? It's because you can't control every single risk. But what you can do is take steps to reduce your risks to an acceptable and well-understood level with the right approach to safety-critical software. Hi and welcome to everybody. This is Don Dingy and I am a small part of the editorial staff with Open Systems Media. I'll be your moderator for our program on enabling certified safety critical software reuse on next generation avionics and multi-core systems, sponsored by DDCI. As your Jungle Cruise director, I will give you a quick tour of your viewing experience today. I'll have a couple of thoughts to go with that. We will then hear from the person you came to hear from, our expert guest, and we will also take your questions in a question and answer session. Hey, if you've been with us, you're back. Thanks. Here I am once again. Bear with me a minute. If it's your first time, thanks for joining. And here are some viewing tips for the session. You are seeing some great slides, or at least will be shortly, on the right half of your screen. And if you'd like, you can go to a larger view of those slides and see everything on them just by clicking the Enlarge Slides button. You can also download the slides used today by clicking the Download button. You can invite a friend who should be watching this. And during today's presentation, assuming you've got your pop-up blockers shut off and all such things, you'll be seeing a short poll which you can answer at your discretion. Responses are certainly appreciated. And then finally, on the lower left-hand side of the screen, there is the Ask a Question box. Just type your questions in there. We will address the best of those after the presentation. Type away and hit Submit Question. So with that, the idea of moving targets. Certification for safety critical systems, things like DL-178B, great stuff. The idea is, like we talked about, to reduce risk, but it should be the risk of uncontrolled changes to the application, unplanned, uncontrolled, unacceptable things that you don't understand. Not controlled changes, like when you plan improvements with hardware upgrades and you really don't touch the application itself, you're just putting it on faster hardware, or even simpler things like moving tasks around. You've got some multi-core hardware and you want to shift tasks from core A to core B. Even a simple thing like that shouldn't present an entire complete recertification. So the question is, how do you avoid that in a scenario like DL-178B or other safety critical environments? And that's what we are here to learn about today. Time to bring in our expert for a deeper look at reuse in safety critical software and some of these risk reduction concepts. I will introduce Tim King. He is a technical marketing manager at DDCI. He is responsible for technical marketing functions with an emphasis on DEOS, DDCI's time and space partition real-time operating system. He has over 20 years of experience developing and marketing commercial avionics and RTOS software. He's got a master's in computer science from the University of Iowa and an MBA from Arizona State University, go ASU. Again, you can submit your questions anytime during this presentation. The sooner the better so we can see them. Submit your thoughts, and with that, we will bring Tim on. Tim, we're ready.
Okay, thanks, Don. So, as Don mentioned, I'm Tim King, and I'm the Technical Marketing Manager for DEOS here at DDCI. And I've been designing, implementing, certifying, and marketing safety-critical avionics and real-time operating system software for over 20 years. And I've been through dozens of DL-178B certifications with certification authorities from around the world. DDCI has been a leading supplier of embedded software products for 30 years, and during that time, we focused primarily on Ada, C, C++, and our Eclipse-based IDE called Open Arbor. In 2008, DDCI entered into an exclusive license agreement with Honeywell to bring DEOS to market as a commercial off-the-shelf RTOS. DEOS is the best-in-class safety-critical partitioned operating system on the market today, and we now employ the entire DEOS development and support team, including myself. Since mid-2009, DDCI has had complete responsibility for all DEOS product enhancements, customer support, and certification activities. And since we deal primarily in airborne software, you might guess that DDCI has a fair amount of experience with software certification in DL-178B, and we do. We've certified software on dozens of aircraft from companies like Airbus, Boeing, Cessna, Dassault, Embraer, and Gulfstream, to name a few. And DEOS has been certified in support of just about every cockpit avionics function you could name. And finally, we've certified through most of the world's certification authorities. Okay, so here's our agenda. First, we'll discuss the what and why of software reuse, and then we'll talk about some types of reuse. Now, keep in mind, this webinar isn't intended to be a primer on software reuse, but setting some context will help with the subsequent discussions. And next, we'll discuss some impediments to reuse, especially with respect to safety-critical software. And then we'll discuss a proven solution. And finally, we'll have some time for Q&A. So let's start with a simple definition. Software reuse occurs when you use existing software and related artifacts in the design and implementation of a new software system. Some might put it differently, but that's reuse in a nutshell. So why would I want to reuse software? Well, that's pretty simple too. I want to take advantage of software resources that have been proven in previous systems. I want to reduce my workload, I want to shorten my schedule, and I want to minimize costs. The bottom line, I can produce more products, better products, more quickly and cheaply. Now, who doesn't want that? Anyhow, that's the theory. We just have to figure out how to achieve reuse and do it effectively. So let's look at a few types of reuse. And again, I don't intend this to be a dissertation on software reuse. I just want to set some context. That said, you can look at software reuse from a couple different angles. So let's look at two. From one angle, you can look at high-level languages as a type of reuse. Basically, constructs in a high-level language embody reusable design and implementation patterns in a lower-level language. That's true of well-known languages like C++ and Java at one level and how they embody these patterns in assembly code. It's also true of languages like SetL, which is based on set theory, or graphical languages, which operate at much more abstract levels. From another angle, you can look at the rigor and control involved. At one end of this spectrum, with so-called ad hoc reuse, you scavenge code snippets, design fragments, and so on from wherever you can find them, and somehow bash them together into something that hopefully works. Little forethought or planning is involved, and you can imagine that it rarely pays dividends. At the other end of this spectrum, with so-called component-based reuse, you begin with a careful analysis of a problem domain, its requirements, architectures, and so on, and carefully craft a set of components that are designed to work with one another in various combinations. A component-based approach can yield significant dividends, and what we'll be talking about in more detail is a variant of this approach. As I just mentioned, software reuse done well can yield significant benefits. However, with safety-critical software, there's a catch. It's the mountain of certification evidence that accompanies the software. Your investment in that evidence dwarfs your investment in the software and its associated binary executable. And if you have to crack open your reuse software and make changes to adapt it to a new environment, for example, maybe a new platform and a new aircraft, then recompile, relink, and generate a new binary file, then you have to crack open that mountain of certification evidence and potentially do a lot of rework. That rework can be costly and can take a lot of time, even for small changes. And the kicker is most reuse techniques virtually guarantee that you'll end up modifying your binary executable. So I use the phrase mountain of certification evidence, but what is that really? I'm sure that most of you here are familiar with what I'm talking about, but let's recap in case someone is new to DL178B. It starts with your plan for software aspects of certification, or a PSAC, and the related planning documents. Those are the plans for development, verification, configuration management, and quality assurance. To be fair, these planning documents are unlikely to change when you reuse software, but most everything else listed here is subject to change should you have to modify your software in order to reuse it in a new system. A change to the software typically means a change to requirements and design, and as a result, newer modified tests. Those changes lead to re-reviews, retesting, redoing traceability and structural coverage analysis, and then buttoning things up with updated back-end documents like the software configuration index and the software accomplishment summary. In addition, as you work through the process, you have the added burden associated with configuration management and quality assurance. All in all, even a small change can be expensive and time-consuming. So what if there was a way to reuse a binary file unchanged on one system after another? No change to the binary implies no change to the software and no change to that mountain of certification evidence. Of course, you still have to do some amount of software hardware and software integration testing in the new target environment, but that's a much smaller undertaking than if you have to modify the software and the binary executable and then crack open that mountain of certification evidence. You'd save significant time and cost. So how would that work? Here we see an example of an architecture of a DDoS-based software system. For the moment, let's ignore the items obscured behind the red dotted line, kind of in the lower center there. I'll get to those in the next slide. In this example, there are two applications, each consisting of a set of processes, as well as a set of DDoS support processes. In DDoS, a process is a space partition. Not shown here is that each process contains one or more threads, each of which performs a task. Each thread has an execution rate, a fixed time budget, an instruction pointer, and a stack. And DDoS schedules these threads concurrently using rate monotonic scheduling. And in DDoS, a thread is a time partition. There are three things to note here. First, DDoS supports a very modular architecture, and we'll discuss this further in subsequent slides. And in particular, processes are independent of one another and of the DDoS kernel. We're not looking at a monolithic build here. Rather, we're looking at many independent software entities. Second, DDoS supports very efficient interrupt handling. Once a connection is established between an interrupt and the thread that services that interrupt, DDoS is out of the way, resulting in very low interrupt latencies. This is in contrast to ARINC 653 that employs a fixed cyclic scheduler. And third, with DDoS, device drivers execute in user mode. They don't have to be implemented as part of the BSP or the kernel. And as a result, you don't have to artificially inflate the driver's design assurance level to that of the kernel, which is typically level A. Okay, so let's focus on the abstraction layer sitting under the DDoS kernel and the user processes. That's the stuff circled by the red dotted box. We'll start in the middle with the HAL, or the hardware abstraction layer. The HAL isolates the DDoS kernel from the specifics of the underlying CPU, for example, the MMU. And on the right, the PAL, or the platform abstraction layer, isolates the DDoS kernel from the specifics of the underlying platform hardware, for example, timers and interrupts. Together, the HAL and the PAL allow DDoS to be easily ported to new target hardware without modification. Now on the left is the DDoS registry. The registry is a configuration file that tells DDoS what hardware devices and other resources exist on a given target, what processes exist, which resources they own, what threads exist within each process, their execution rates and time budgets, and so on. In essence, the registry abstracts DDoS from the specifics of the software on a given target and allows it to be easily reconfigured for different software loads on new targets without modification. Additionally, the registry abstracts user software from the underlying target hardware so that software frequently can be ported to new target hardware without modification. For example, on one CPU, a given thread may require a 500 microsecond time budget, while on a faster CPU, it might only require 300 microseconds. Since these magic numbers are factored out of the software and put into the registry, it's a simple matter of modifying the registry. No software change is required. Now here we see an illustration of binary modularity and reuse. On the left is target 1, and on the right is target 2. For example, target 2 may be a next generation version of target 1. Binary modularity is the key to reuse in a safety-critical environment. Remember, if you modify the software and then the binary, you have to crack open that mountain of certification evidence, and you want to avoid that if possible. So under DOS, software is a combination of processes and libraries, which correspond to .exes and .sos. In this example, we show a.exe and the DOS kernel. As such, each software entity is a separately loadable binary that has its own design assurance level and its own set of certification artifacts. Now remember the role that the registry plays in abstracting user binaries and the DOS kernel from the underlying target hardware. As a result, it's fairly common that the exact same binaries can be used unmodified on multiple targets. So for example, here we see a.exe and the DOS kernel used in both the target 1 and target 2 environments unchanged. The only difference is the registry. But the real benefit here is because the binaries are unchanged, the same set of certification artifacts can be used when certifying on new targets, and that results in significant time and cost savings. There, it looks like it finally repainted. So as we've seen, binary modularity with an assist from an abstraction layer like the DS registry can go a long way towards achieving effective reuse. But there's one further challenge, I/O, or input and output. Now, if you've worked with safety critical systems and software for long, you know, like I know, that I/O is volatile and changes from target to target, sometimes dramatically. Where data values come from and where they go varies. Data types, engineering units, and data rates vary. So how do you handle this volatility without modifying your software and the associated binary? So before we dive into answering that question, let's just take a brief look at an example. And let's consider a value like airspeed. It could come in via an A to D converter over a bus like 1553 or 429 or AFDX or by some other means. It could be in single or double precision floating point or in fixed point. It could be in feet or meters per second or in Mach. And the rate at which it's updated could vary widely. Now multiply that volatility by several hundred or thousand more data values, and that's a lot of volatility to manage. Well, one way to manage that volatility is with something we call the IOI, or IO infrastructure. IOI is a library that works in conjunction with DOS, and it provides an IO abstraction layer based on a publish-subscribe model. IOI handles periodic and aperiodic data. It handles producers and consumers that run at different rates and manages the buffering that that requires. It supports sampling, queuing, and blackboard behaviors similar to ARINC 653. It handles fixed and variable length messages, and it supports chained reads and writes. Chaining refers to the IOI's ability to handle multiple data values via a single call from user software, even though those values may come from or go to multiple sources or destinations. Another feature of IOI is the ability to inject user-defined formatting functions into the data stream. Formatting functions are primarily used to modify data types, perform engineering unit conversions, and so on. And in the remaining slides, we're going to take a much closer look at all of this. Okay, so let's look at an example of IOI in action. In this example, process A writes airspeed in step A1. I've used color coding to show that airspeed, as produced by A, is in a given engineering unit, represented here by orange. In particular, let's say that orange corresponds to feet per second. So when A writes airspeed, IOI stores the value in a block of local RAM that it controls. That's step 1B. However, before storing airspeed, it invokes a formatting function which converts feet per second to meters per second, represented here by green. So how does IOI know to invoke the FPS to MPS formatting function? that converts feet per second to meters per second? It's simple. It was configured to do so in the IOI registry. Okay, so far. Now let's look at the step two. Here, process B reads airspeed in step two, 2A. Since IOI knows that B wants airspeed in meters per second, which is how airspeed was stored when A wrote it, IOI reads the stored value from RAM in step 2B and passes it back to B in step 2C. So how does IOI know that B wants airspeed in meters per second? And how does it know that B wants the airspeed value produced by A and not someone else? Well, again, it was configured that way in the IOI registry. And finally, process C reads airspeed in step 3A. Now, since IOI knows that C wants airspeed in Mach, it reads the stored value from RAM in step 3B and invokes a formatting function which converts meters per second to Mach, represented here by yellow. IOI then passes airspeed back to C in step 3C. And once again, how does IOI know that C wants airspeed in Mach and then it wants the airspeed value produced by A? That's right, the IOI registry. So why is this important, and how does it facilitate reuse by addressing the volatility of I/O? Well, let's look at those two questions. What I show here is the same example we just walked through where A produces airspeed in feet per second, and then it's consumed by B and C in different units. And don't forget the formatting functions that they play. That's the scenario on target one. Now let's assume the process B is your software and that you have invested significant time and money in it. Further, let's assume that you want to reuse B on another target, say target two, which might be a next gen version of target one or something entirely different. The point is you want to reuse B without modification on target two, despite the fact that the IO on target 2 may be entirely different than on target 1. Well, target 2 is shown in the lower half of this slide. Now notice how airspeed is now produced by process D, not A as in target 1. And further, it's now produced in Mach, not in feet per second as in target 1. Again, I've used color coding to represent engineering units. But since you don't want to modify your software B, we simply reconfigure the IOI via the registry to know that B now consumes airspeed from D, not A, and that we use a different formatting function that converts Mach to meters per second. IOI handles the rest, and B remains unchanged. That is, the exact same B binary is used on both targets 1 and 2, even though the IO is entirely different. Now, you might be wondering, why didn't I just code D such that it produces airspeed in Mach? Well, you could do that if you were coding D from scratch, but for the sake of argument, let's assume that we're reusing D also from some other system and that we don't want to change it either. Further, without something like IOI, we'd still have to modify B such that it consumed airspeed from D, not A, on target 2. Okay, well that seems great, but how can IOI help us in a multi-core environment? Again, let's start with the same baseline scenario, and let's assume that the software, including your software B, all executes on core 0 of target 1. Now, let's assume for some reason, let's say load balancing, we decide to move process B and C to core 1 and leave A on core 0. And again, let's assume that we want to reuse B without modification, despite the fact that it now resides on core 1 and the producer of airspeed still resides on core 0. Well, IOI to the rescue once again. In the lower half of this slide, I've shown the new configuration. A remains on core 0 while B and C now reside on core 1. All changes are isolated to the IOI registry in this example. Now when A writes airspeed, The IOI on core 0 knows to write the value to memory that is shared by the two cores, rather than RAM that's local on one core. Also note that the IOI on core 0 does not invoke a formatting function during the write. This illustrates the fact that formatting functions can be associated with the writing of a value or with the reading of the value, or both. Similarly, when B reads AirSpeed, the IOI on core 1 knows to read the value from the memory shared by the two cores, and further, core 1's IOI knows to invoke the formatting function that converts feet per second to meters per second when B reads AirSpeed. Again, this is configured by the IOI registry. You might also notice now that A, C, and the formatting functions are unchanged as well. To reiterate, all changes are isolated in the IOI registry, and the exact same binaries are used in both scenarios, even though A now resides on a different core than B and C. So let's take a little closer look at configuring the IOI. On this slide, we see the big picture, and on subsequent slides, we'll look at things in more detail. From the big picture perspective, there are two key roles. In the first role, software engineers write the software that becomes the binary files loaded onto a target platform. And here again, we see A, B, and C. In addition, they create what we call IOI config files written in XML for each process. Each IOI config file defines what items are produced by a given process and what values are consumed. But at this point, it's important to understand that these items are unbound. For example, in B's IOI config file, we define that B consumes AirSpeed and we note what units, etc., B expects, but we don't know where that value comes from. That comes in the next step. In that second step, under the second role, platform integrators create a binder file, again in XML, which defines bindings between produced and consumed items and defines any formatting functions that might be required. Those formatting functions are then implemented by the software engineers. In our working example, we bound the AirSpeed value produced by A to the AirSpeed value consumed by B, along with the FPS to MPS formatting function, feet per second to meters per second. And from there, the IOI registry builder grabs each process's IOI config file, along with a binder file and the formatting functions, and creates the IOI registry file that gets loaded onto the target. And as we've seen, this registry file configures the IOI for that target. Now, it might sound complicated, but it's really pretty simple. So let's take a look at how all this is actually accomplished. First, let's look at how produced items are defined in a process's IOI config file. Again, using our AirSpeed example, we'd see this XML snippet in A's IOI config file. Here we see that A will produce AirSpeed once every 80,000 microseconds, which works out to once every 12.5 milliseconds or 80 hertz. The message form specifies a single D, which indicates a double precision floating point value. There are other designators for other data types, like I for integer and so on. This message form value is used by IOI when processing AirSpeed. And next, we see that A produces AirSpeed in feet per second. However, unlike message form, the message units field is simply a comment. It's not used by the IOI, but it is used by the platform integrators when determining what formatting functions might be needed. Buffer type and buffer options tell the IOI how to handle the buffering of AirSpeed. And finally, the comment field is freeform commentary intended for the platform integrators. Now let's look at how consumed items are defined in a process's IOI config file. Again, with AirSpeed, we'd see this XML snippet in B's IOI config file. Here we see that B expects to consume AirSpeed once every 80,000 microseconds or 80 hertz, but it's able to take a value produced at half that rate. That's the minimum data rate. Again, it expects a double precision floating point value, but in meters per second. Freshness check and consumption options tell IOI what produced value to select, for example, first in, first out, last in, first out, and when to consider a value fresh or stale. And again, the comment field is freeform commentary intended for the platform integrators. Okay. So far, we've defined who produces what and who consumes what, but we haven't connected the dots, so to speak. In our example, when B consumes airspeed, which process does it come from? That's the job of the platform integrators as they create the binder file. Remember, the IOI registry builder uses the binder file along with all the IOI config files to build the IOI registry for a given target. In the binder file, we'd see this XML snippet regarding who produces airspeed. In this case, it's produced by process A into shared memory on a single core. In the multi-core case that we discussed, it would be produced into a memory-mapped RAM device shared by multiple cores. The value's name is airspeed, and we've associated a formatting function with the writing of airspeed, the one that converts feet per second into meters per second. From the consumer's view, we'd see this XML snippet regarding who consumes airspeed in the binder file. In this case, B consumes airspeed from process A. From B's perspective, no formatting function is needed, since the conversion from feet per second to meters per second happens when A produces airspeed. Now, alternatively, the formatting function could be associated with the consumption of airspeed, as we saw in the multi-core example. And last but not least, let's look at how a formatting function is defined in the binder file. In this case, it's the formatting function used when A produces airspeed and converts feet per second to meters per second. And as I mentioned earlier, coding of that formatting function is left as an exercise for the software engineers. Okay, so where does that leave us? I'd like to reiterate a couple key points. First, when done right, software reuse can yield significant benefits, especially if you're dealing with safety-critical software. Remember, the bang for the buck doesn't lie with the reuse of the software per se. It comes from the reuse of the mountain of certification evidence that accompanies that software. And second, if you haven't modified the binary executable, by inference, you haven't modified the certification evidence. And if you haven't modified the certification evidence, you haven't exposed yourself to a lot of time-consuming and costly rework. And third, binary modularity and I/O abstraction are key to enabling reuse. Whether you're targeting reuse on a different platform, on a multi-core processor, or on a multi-processor platform, system-to-system I/O is the most volatile factor. And if you can control that, you can control your schedule and your cost. Well, that wraps up this portion of the presentation. I'd like to thank you for your time and attention. And if you want to learn more about this or other key topics, please visit us at ddci.com. And with that, I'll turn things back over to Don.
And with that, don't go anywhere because we're about to begin our Q&A portion, which is usually very compelling stuff. It's a good chance to ask Tim questions and get some answers to that. I do want to remind everybody that we are with Tim King. He is Technical Marketing Manager for DDCI. Tim, I want to start with a couple language clarifying questions and make sure we've got everybody calibrated. One is about DL178B certified. And I know there's a difference between certified and a word that describes me, certifiable. But you have some 178A certification actual and some activity on 178B. Maybe you could clarify where you are at certified versus certifiable real quick.
The DDoS software has been under the umbrella of DL178B since day one. By the time that DDoS development had started, DL178A, which has become known, was pretty much waning, and DL-178B was the new game in town for any new development. As far as certified versus certifiable, it is more technically correct to say that software like a DOS or another software component, or even a flight controls application or displays, are certifiable. In particular, the Europeans are very sticky about this point. The FAA less so, but basically, you certify an aircraft. You don't certify software by itself. But so when people are being a little more precise, they will say it is certifiable. But taking that just the next step further, DOS has been certified on many different aircraft, dozens actually. So hopefully that clears up that point.
Yeah, I think it does. It's just some vocabulary, right? You're mm-hmm. actually certifying the entire platform, the big bad aircraft platform, and not just the components that go into it. It's just kind of a thing when somebody says, "Are you certified?" Well, yes, we're in something that is certified. I think that's a good discussion. So there's another similar question here we could hit probably really quickly. The question's about boards, but I think maybe it's more appropriate. What general architectures is DOS supporting today, processor-wise? I'm assuming you're portable to a variety of board support platforms.
Yeah. Short answer is DOS is deployed and quote-unquote certified or certifiable on a wide variety of Intel x86 processors, as well as a wide variety of PowerPC processors.
Wide variety of things, and I'm sure your teams will work with specific boards on customer requests. Let's see if we can sort out some of these questions. There's quite a few questions that are here, and they're targeting the abstraction concept. There's several people asking a very similar question. So registry updates, aren't they basically an abstraction? Instead of changing the binary, you're actually changing the registry. Isn't the IO config file what requires certification? Maybe you could clarify exactly, go back to the abstraction concept a little bit and
sure.
see how that works.
Sure, of course. The DOS registry and the IOI registry are, they start out life as XML files, and they get compiled into binary form, which gets loaded onto the target. And then they are used to, by DOS to configure the DOS kernel, so it knows what processes and threads to light up, what rates things run at, what time budgets are there, who owns what resources, et cetera, et cetera. And then it enforces the time, space, and resource partitioning. And similarly, the IO registry is used to configure the IOI on a given target, so that it knows, where data are coming from, where they're going to, what formatting functions need to be invoked, when and where, that kind of thing. And they are not executable software, but they do have a significant effect on the behavior of the software, the DOS kernel and the IOI, and then the users of IOI in terms of, being able to read and write data. So with those kinds of files, the agreement that I guess the developers have with certification authorities is that it's not executable code, so you don't test it in the sense of, you would write test cases against your, requirements-based tests that would exercise your code. But they are reviewed for correctness, so once these IOI config files or the DOS registry is written in XML, it's reviewed by humans for correctness. And then it is not tested directly, but it is tested indirectly in the process of testing your software as you run your requirements-based tests. And so by inference, the combination of reviews and the direct indirect testing that occur on these XML-based binary files, that has been seen as adequate by the certification authorities.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a point that we need to hammer home here. People asking about the FAA. The FAA has seen this approach and has blessed it, correct? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a hypothetical, this should work. This has been blessed in actual real-life deployed situations. So it's not news to the FAA here. I'm hoping we're hitting a lot of these questions. So let's see. There's some technical questions. We hit a lot of the reuse kind of questions. There's some technical questions about IOI here. Maybe we could start with does IOI support buffered consume of data? Maybe you've got data rates coming in at different rates. Do all the consumes during, say, a 1 hertz rate deal with 10 hertz producers? How does it work with varying data rates between producers and consumers? Might be the way to word that.
Right. And yes, the short answer is IOI does manage that. The little longer answer is that there are a couple of different buffering schemes that you can choose from. But basically, the IOI sets up a set of buffers that are appropriate for the type of behavioral, general behavior you want to see. But it handles, very gracefully. If I have, let's say, an 80 hertz producer and a 1 hertz consumer, that 1 hertz consumer could consume the same value throughout a given period, and it will get the exact same value, even though that value is really being updated at 80 times per second. It's just that the IOI buffering underneath the covers is how that gets managed. And I should also say, this is not to imply that there's a bunch of data copying going on. When a writer writes a value, it gets written once. So it's not being copied to multiple buffers because I've got, buffers for 1 hertz consumers and buffers for 5 hertz consumers and 10 hertz consumers. There is a single value that is written to a single buffer, and then the IOI kind of works buffering magic to make that value stable throughout the reader's period.
Multiple copies going on. Along those lines, one of our questions here is an interesting one. Does IOI support more complicated data types, arrays, structures, those types of things?
Yes, it does. So you can define, basically like a struct or an array. You have to bound the size of it, although it does also handle variable length messages. If you're going to be passing structs around between different processes, you just want to be cognizant of different compilers will do different things in terms of physically laying out what a struct looks like in memory, and if you're dealing with processes created with 2 different compilers, you may have some issues to deal with there.
When you, one of your slides, you were talking about chain reads and writes in IOI. That's a term we usually hear in something like DMA and not necessarily a publish-subscribe position. Can you talk about what you mean when you say chain reads and writes and how that gets set up briefly?
Sure. Let's say that process A wants to read a set of 4 values. I'm going to be creative. We'll call them V1, V2, V3, and V4. And let's say that those 4 values happen to come from 4 different producers. And furthermore, let's say that, if I'm writing A, I'm constructively lazy and I don't want to make 4 separate calls to IOI read. I just 1 call will do. Thank you very much. So that's where the chaining comes in. And in defining A's IOI config file, the software engineer has a way to describe 1 consume item that's actually a composite of V1 through V4. And in that regard, it's a lot like defining a struct in C. Then the platform integrator rigs the binder file so that the IOI will know where to get those four values from, and that when A calls IOI read on this composite value, it gets those four values and presents them to A as a group with one single call from A's perspective. Hopefully that made sense.
We are getting a huge number of great questions. I want to reinforce to everybody that some of these questions are super technical, and the team will see them all and get a chance to follow up with you after the event. We'll do our best to take the good ones here on air. So this is an interesting one. The XML file that we were talking about in the registry, what's the guarantee that that doesn't get corrupted somewhere along the line? Is there a CRC check at runtime? Or you mentioned it's not actually executable software, but how do you make sure that that doesn't get modified underneath you, corrupted somehow, and change the behavior of the system?
Right. That's actually kind of a bigger question, which you could ask about any of the software or any of the other data that's on a given target. Where you might have a bit flipped or a stuck bit or something which corrupts the file or the executable code. So as I mentioned earlier, it's not the XML doesn't actually go down onto the target. It's compiled into a binary form, and that binary is what gets loaded on the target. Every file that's loaded onto a DS target is wrapped with a CRC, and then as a platform integrator, you have a number of options that you can choose from. You can choose to have your software execute out of RAM if you want, or out of flash. If you choose the out of RAM option, then DS will copy the image out of the kernel file system and map it into RAM. You also have an option of doing the CRC check at startup, so that DS will go through. If you're going to leave a file in flash, it'll calculate that CRC there. If you want to move the file image into RAM, it'll copy the image first, and then it'll perform the CRC check to make sure that that doesn't happen. Now, that's a startup initialization time. Depending on the requirements of your system, you may have continuous bit type activity that's required. One of those activities might be to just kind of continually run through flash, run through RAM, and re-CRC everything at some rate. Just to make sure that, during in-flight operations, a bit doesn't get flipped or stuck or something bad happens like that.
Well, here's an interesting question. While abstraction and things like IOIs are always a great idea, one of the concerns is how much overhead is being introduced. How much overhead is being introduced? Do you have a feeling for what your overhead looks like here?
I don't have exact numbers for you, but...
Yeah, your mileage may vary, but...
Mileage may vary, all that good stuff, right? But actually, there's very little overhead imposed by the IOI. Granted, there's some startup overhead when IOI has to read the IOI registry and gets things configured, but that's actually pretty efficient. And then once things are configured, reads and writes are very efficient. For example, they're directly accessing shared memory. There's no copying of values. DOS is not involved. It's out of the way. And the IOI manages things very efficiently. We've had some what I call power users that have used IOI to process many hundreds of values at relatively high data rates, 40 hertz, 80 hertz, 100 hertz. I don't think anybody's cracked 1,000 values yet, but I don't see that would necessarily cause any problems. IOI is very scalable as well. So really, from kind of a qualitative point of view, the bottom line is you get an enormous amount of flexibility at very little cost.
So one of the benefits of a publish-subscribe model is it does keep integrity and synchronization between, like you said, you can scale this, right? Once you join the subscriber network, the published data is available throughout the network. The question is maintaining integrity and synchronization. I guess it's really understanding how the publish-subscribe model works. Is that right?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
Yeah, I'm trying to – how do you maintain integrity and synchronization between different applications? So, I mean, the publish-subscribe model is a node has to join the network as a subscriber, and then the publisher pushes out the data, and all the subscribers have that data available, and that's how things stay in sync, right? Maybe you can clarify that a bit.
Right. So once the connecting the dots step is accomplished during initialization, you know, so the information that we were talking about that goes into the binder that says, when B says, I wish to consume airspeed, what it really means is, on this target, I want to consume it airspeed from A. That was the example we used on a number of occasions. Once that's established, I mean, there's potentially some, you might think of an integrity issue there where that might get done incorrectly. But the IOI software has been designed to level A design assurance, so it's very unlikely that that sort of step would get corrupted somehow. There's another angle to the integrity issue, which I think is, if I'm understanding where that question's coming from, is handled by the underlying buffering that the IOI does. As I mentioned before, for example, let's say we're still talking airspeed, and airspeed is produced at 80 hertz, and maybe I've got a 1 hertz consumer of that data, and within a period, no matter how many times that 1 hertz consumer tries to read that value of airspeed, it will get the exact same value every time, even though airspeed is actually being updated at 80 hertz. It would be a really bad thing if, towards the beginning of the period, I read airspeed and I get, you know, 500 miles an hour, and later on in my period, I read that same airspeed value and I get 530 miles an hour. So that sort of integrity is maintained by the buffering that the IOI controls. If you want to pop up a level, if you have really critical data, you could always wrap it in a CRC or a checksum, whatever is appropriate, and then on either end, you know, have the producer and the consumer validate that CRC value. That sort of functionality could also be buried in one of those formatting functions if you wanted to.
There's a lot of things you could do with these types of architectures once you get the publish-subscribe model running. A couple quick questions, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up. Is there an Indian issue, a little Indian, big Indian? Does it matter?
It would matter if you were working in a system where you had a mix of little Indian, big Indian processors. And so typically there what you would do is you would define a Endianism for the entire system. And then, let's say for ILI, again, you could bury that sort of conversion into the formatting function if you wanted to, so that you wouldn't have to change software. And then again, if you're reusing software, yeah, I don't want to have to go change it because, well, I'm little Endian and now I'm getting big Endian data, so I got to go do my own conversion, because then I've got to go rewrite a bunch of requirements and read views and yada, yada, yada. So just bury it in a formatting function.
Interesting. And that's a pretty real-life scenario, too. You could add one more box that would have a different Indianism, and you'd have to be able to deal with that. So, again, you've thought through that, obviously. You've thought a little bit about multi-core CPUs here, too. I am very sure that the answer is DOS is multi-core aware. One question here is kind of interesting, that certification on multi-core has never been done, or at least maybe has never been done because of shared memory. Has DIOS been certified on a multi-core target? And maybe you could describe a specific instance of that.
Not yet. We are in the process of working through that.
Okay.
There are a couple of unique features that enable DIOS to work well in a multi-core environment and that give us high confidence that we will be able to achieve a certification in a multi-core setting. And we're talking asymmetric multiprocessing, not symmetric. I want to be very clear about that. Two kind of key features. First is that we have some patented cache partitioning technology that allows DIOS to minimize contention when you've got multiple cores banging on the same L2 cache. And then we have something called slack scheduling, which allows you to recover slack time, which gets generated in larger quantities on multi-core systems. I can't really get into much detail here because we're kind of running out of time, but we did a webinar on the multi-core topic back in mid-February. It might have been a little after the 15th, somewhere in there. So you might want to visit the Open Systems Media website and check that out.
Super. And then I should also mention
that there's a link to that on our DCI homepage.
Yep, and we'll have the archive link up here in a couple of minutes when we wrap up. Last question for this session. So a couple ideas here about porting binaries to other aircraft or to other hardware with different timing. Can you deploy the same binary? Do you have to worry about things like your hardware performance changing, the timing of things and deadlines changing? Maybe you could comment generally on that idea.
Yeah, of course you would have to factor those things into account. From the DIOS kernel's point of view, one of the things that we do in that regard is there's a set of tests that we run with a version of the kernel we call the critical time kernel, but when the target hardware is available, we run those tests with the critical time kernel, and what it does is it measures some critical time values on the target hardware, like how much time does it take for a context switch and what is the timing of the worst-case critical section and a variety of other things. And then those values get plugged into the DIOS registry that's used on that platform so that DIOS can do time accounting and other things accurately in that environment. So that handles the DIOS side of things. Now, for an application, you would still need to, you know, worry about, well, if I'm on a really slow processor now, what does that do to my timing margins and so on and so on? Or if I've gone the other direction, what happens? So you would have to assess those things. And they could have an effect on, you know, driving software changes. I don't mean to, by what we presented here today, I don't mean that, you know, the IOI and the things we talked about solve any and all problems and make, you know, it's just magic pixie dust that makes it all work anytime, every time, but it sure gives you a much better chance that you would be able to achieve this binary reuse that we were talking about.
I like that statement. Pixie dust is great, but definitely something where you need to take a look. What we talked about in the opening was reducing risks. So I think you did a great job of addressing that during the presentation and the Q&A. Told you guys the Q&A would be good. I want to go ahead and wrap up. We have just heard about enabling certified safety critical software reuse on next generation avionics and multi-core systems from our featured guest, Tim King. Thanks to him for sharing his expertise and to DDCI for their sponsorship. This event and other ECASTs are archived at the URL now shown on your screen. Tim had mentioned that these archived ECASTs contain other material from DDCI. These archived ECASTs can be replayed at your convenience. We'd certainly enjoy hearing how we did with today's program. Please contact us at the email address shown. That would be for Christine Long, our online magician in residence. Thanks to her as always, and thanks to all of you for being with us during the program. Please join us again on behalf of our guests and all of us here at Open Systems Media. This is Don Dingy saying find something good, build something better, and help someone be happy today. See you soon.